Now, ladies and gentlemen, what Thomas Paine was, in terms of physical science, is in fact a characteristic of all of the major developers of freedom at all times. I don't think anybody can develop anything in the volitional domain of any novel, or rather of any innovative value, unless he first familiarizes himself with the laws of nature, where we understand them, and go into areas where we still don't understand them. The only other thing you can do in the area of freedom is to study the works of those who have and get a historical perspective with respect to what other people who are more creative have done, and then just compile them. If you're not a compiler, but an innovator, then you have to start with physical science to get into freedom. And freedom does not come through politicians or through political activists. That is the significance of the American Revolution. That is the significance of Thomas Paine, who is the ideological spearhead and central figure of the American Revolution. He was not a politician. He never worked successfully in politics. I could almost say he never worked in politics at all, but there are two exceptions to this. Both of them ended in disaster for him. He was made the first Secretary of Foreign Affairs, which I guess corresponds with Secretary of State in the earlier provisional government. And he didn't ask for this. This was not an elective job. He was appointed by the Continental Congress. I omitted mentioning this, by the way. This is another proof that, not a proof, but this is another hint that he might have been the author of the Declaration of Independence. The others are stronger proofs. This is merely a hint. The Continental Congress made him the first Secretary of Foreign Affairs. Why should they do this? Who was he? A penniless immigrant from Great Britain who had previously to this been employed as a corset maker, a tutor, an excise man, and various other useless activities in Great Britain. He came to America, was here 1 year, wrote a couple of fiery pamphlets. Why should they make him first Secretary of Foreign Affairs? He was not a plantation owner. He was not a businessman in New England. Why should they pick him, of all people? The suggestion is that Joseph Lewis, who wrote that book on the Declaration of Independence, is being written by Paine. The suggestion is, and I have to agree with him, the Continental Congress, those people knew he wrote it, except it was being deliberately concealed, and this was their way of rewarding him. And foolishly, he accepted. And he got into a lot of political trouble. I won't take time in this course, because I think it's rather trivial. If you are really interested, read a biography of Thomas Paine, and it's in the chapter that's called The Silas Deane Affair. He got into a skirmish with a character called Silas Deane, and before long he had to resign in disgrace. And the point is, his one activity in politics in America ended in personal problems and unhappiness for himself, and he accomplished nothing. The other thing is, when he got to France, as you know, this I did mention, he was made the delegate to the French National Assembly to represent the Department of Calais. And again, foolishly, he accepted. He didn't ask for this, but foolishly, he accepted. This nearly cost him his life. We went through that last session. This nearly shortened him by a head. And it did permanently impair his health, because the prison he was in for 11 months injured his health for the rest of his life. Nothing good came out of it. And the significant thing I'm emphasizing is that everything that Thomas Paine is remembered for is what he did outside of his two political jobs. It's what he wrote, what he thought, and how he influenced the other men, such as Jefferson and Washington and the Frenchmen, Lafayette and Condorcet. How he influenced these men, and through them and through his writings, the masses. He worked in what I call ideology. He worked with ideas. He was not a coercer. He never was a politician. He didn't run for president. I don't think he wanted the job. And if he had been it, president, he would have flopped like everybody else. He wouldn't have been a bit better. That is not the area he excelled in. And the Declaration of Independence, finally, on this point, the Declaration of Independence itself is not, I repeat, is not a political document. It is an ideological document. There is nothing in here about setting up a legislature or electing a president or a king. There is nothing in here about how to run the country, how to tell people how to live, how much taxes they ought to pay. There's nothing in here about that. It's a statement of principles. It has two kinds of principles in it, great ones and little ones. The little ones are, it's a critique of the bad things the British king did and why he has no right to continue his business as king in America. And the big principles They're in the early part of the Declaration of Independence. They are the permanent universal principles about individual freedom and individual sovereignty over the, what is called the government. That government rules by consent of the governed, that the individual is higher and the government is a servant. Those are my words, but the principles are in the Declaration. I might also add, to Paine's credit and to the discredit of the final Declaration, which is not Paine's mangling, I might add that the expression mangled version of the Declaration is not my terminology, nor even that of Joseph Lewis. It's Charles Henry Lee of the Revolutionary period who wondered why the Declaration was so mangled between the original version and the final one. The original version is much superior to the way it was finally published, and that's the way Paine wrote it. And that is a much stronger declaration of individual freedom and subservience of the what he called government. I personally make a distinction between government and state, I'd like to point out. I don't wish to go into that in great detail here, but the usage of the word government by Thomas Paine in the Declaration of Independence is compatible with freedom. But what I call state is not compatible with it. As I say, in this course, we don't have time to pursue that too far. That is a major point to be made in V50. I'd like to emphasize that this Declaration of Independence is, in effect, an ideological statement of principles and not a political program of how to rule. And from this point on, we have many further things to learn. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the subject of the American Revolution brings us into direct contact with the present. What I have called the American Revolution is, in fact, not over. We shouldn't talk about it exclusively in the past tense. We should also include it in the present tense. The American Revolution is still on. We can call the American Revolution the social application, or the volitional application, let's say, of the liberal revolution. The liberal revolution is a larger concept. It is a liberating one, one that frees man from the previous concepts of tyranny. There are two basic manifestations of this liberal revolution. The first manifestation is applied to social structure. The American Revolution was an attempt to create a social structure based upon natural laws rather than human coercion. Coercion is the ability of one man to impose his volition, his choices, upon another man's behavior. A king, for example, imposes his will on his subject. You will do this, you will do that, you will pay me this, and you will be drafted in my army to fight my wars, to protect you, and pay for it, because we need it. These are coercive impositions of will of one man upon another. The American Revolution was an attempt in the early days of 1776 on the part of Paine, his colleagues, his antecedents, and his, not so much his successors, but his immediate successors for a short time, to try to reduce this to practice so that you can develop a social structure based on natural principles rather than upon human imposition of will upon other human beings. As I pointed out, it was not completely successful. It was temporarily successful to the extent that the king was dethroned. Not merely King George III as one obnoxious individual who was imposing his will on many other people, but all kings were deposed. It wasn't that George III was followed by Paul IX or by Frederick II or by John II or whatever it is. He was not followed by any king at all. That is a concept which is new. It was Thomas Paine's concept that man ought not be ruled by single leaders or monarchs. At that time, it was a completely novel idea. It was revolutionary in the truest sense of the word. Today you might tend to shrug your shoulders and say, well, what's new about that? I mean, you've been used to not having a king. You've grown up to believe that we don't have a king in this country because the propaganda says we don't. We call him president. We change the name and we change how long he reigns. We have to resuscitate him every 4 years and give him his license back to continue. I don't want to go into that in so much with so much facetious intent at the moment. Let's just put it on this basis. The idea that there should not be a single ruler or monarch. The idea that no man need bow before another one and say, "Your Majesty," and be afraid to rise until he is given the command, "You may rise." The idea that a man has to submit and bend and bow before another man. To Thomas Paine, this was an abhorrent concept. It became abhorrent to his colleagues and successors. It now is natural. In this country, you don't think of kings, and so you have grown acclimatized to it, and you fail to see how revolutionary it was. But put yourself back in the 18th century, and you'd realize that this was unheard of at the time. People just didn't think in terms of no kings. Well, somebody's got to make the rules. Somebody's got to maintain law and order. Well, if we don't have a man setting the rules, well, the whole country will go to pot. Well, there'll be disorder. There'll be rioting in the streets. We'll have wars. We'll be invaded. Who's going to see to it that none of these things happen? Somebody's got to be above petty bickering and trivial factional disputes and partisanship. Somebody's got to rise above party and be a figurehead, a symbol for the solidarity and integrity and unity of a nation. He's got to be a man at the top. It was unheard of that no one should rule. Well, the American Revolution began as a deposition of rulership. It got off the track, as you realize. We've got a far worse rulership than the American colonists ever had. Our taxes are so high, are so vastly higher than the colonists suffered, that it just makes me wonder what kind of human beings live today that they put up with these types of interferences with their property, which the colonists wouldn't hear of. Why, if you just pricked them with a pin, they would scream and howl, "I've been stabbed." Today, you can chop a man's life out. You can cut his heart out. You can chop his legs off. But if it's done in the interest of the public welfare, and because it's necessary for the national defense and for the good of the country, he'll let you do all these things. Chop his legs off, shoot him, kill him. Now, how did we change? What happened? How did the home of the brave become the home of the gutless? How did the land of the free become the land of the slave? What happened? What happened was that America had a hell of a good thing going for a while, and a heck of a lot of property got developed because there was a very major change after the American Revolution began in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. I want to point out the liberal revolution began much earlier, but the American Revolution is its volitional manifestation. It had one other manifestation in the physical technological realm, not the Industrial Revolution. They both are branches of the same liberal revolution. The Industrial Revolution is liberating man from the chores of manual labor so he can produce more through machinery and he can have a higher standard of living and have more property to enjoy. The Industrial Revolution couldn't have happened unless there was a similar social development at the same time, which is called the American Revolution. The American Revolution is not geographically isolated to America either. It influenced all of Europe later. The whole of Europe became influenced, or at least Western Europe. This doesn't include certain feudal countries like Tsarist Russia, the Balkans, and a few other backward areas. Spain remained an absolute monarchy until the 20th century. Serbia, which is in the Balkans, was a backward primitive nation and started World War I, as you know. Not coincidentally, I might add. There was quite a correlation between their backwardness and their pulling the trigger for World War I. The point is, most of the nations of Western Europe became completely influenced by the American Revolution. This American Revolution created a tremendous social and physical change in all the countries that it affected. Among the things that happened was nobody knew what the new rules were. Nobody knew who to go to for top decision-making as to how to run your life. People had to be on their own. What a terrible thing. If they wanted to decide to open a business, they didn't have to go get a permit from the king. If they wanted to do something, they just did it. And all of a sudden, this country blossomed from a primitive, backward country, which today is called underdeveloped. The United States at that time was an underdeveloped country. It developed from an underdeveloped country to the most developed nation in the world. Why? Because the American Revolution changed the rules of coercion. Now, please note, I didn't say it eliminated coercion. I said it changed the rules of it. The intention was, by Paine and others, to eliminate coercion. The technology for doing this, however, was not fully developed. It was started then, and I give full credit to them in the sense that we have a much higher technology to do this now, and that's what is taught in Course V50 of the Free Enterprise Institute. And this is a new concept, completely different, and completely beyond anything that has ever happened anywhere in the world to this date, what is taught at the Free Enterprise Institute. It's a completely revolutionary concept. But its only historical antecedent, which I can freely and happily acknowledge, is the American Revolution, which is anchored in the liberal revolution and in the Newtonian development of physical science. The point is that this whole development, which started in the 18th century in America, led to a changed system. It did not change things completely to the point where coercion was eliminated. This is what should have happened, but it didn't. And there's no point in saying, well, it might have been, or it could have been, or it should have been. It wasn't. Coercion was not eliminated. We have got, still, a form of social structure, a so-called government, which retained coercion and ultimately became a grander wielder of coercion than even the ancient monarchies. But in the short run, and by that I mean immediately following 1776 and the next century thereafter, that's short run when you think in terms of thousands of years of human history. 100 years is short run. In the next 100 years, things were so confused as far as coercion is concerned in this country, nobody knew who the king was. See, anybody wanted to be king couldn't. The word was discredited. Nobody dared call himself king because nobody wanted one anymore, thanks to Thomas Paine. At first, it was considered a dangerous idea. Well, how can a country be without a king? And then this country showed how it could be without a king. And it prospered better. Why, in Europe, they were taking bets as to how soon the United States would collapse because it had no king. Like those barbarians, those savages across the ocean, well, look at the crazy people. They threw the king out. How long do you think this can go on? Oh, they'll learn. They're going to get another king pretty soon. They can't last this way. But the ones who learned were in Europe. When the United States went through several decades of no king, and instead of collapsing, it grew. And from an underdeveloped and poverty-stricken country, it became a wealthy and huge industrial nation. Europeans took a second look, and then they started getting rid of their kings. As a matter of fact, this started very early in France. That's what Thomas Paine was busy doing, getting rid of the monarchy in France, as I pointed out last time in the second session of this course. And Paine, unlike the hotheads in France, Paine made a supreme distinction between getting rid of the monarchy and getting rid of the king. He had nothing to do with the assassination of the French king, the guillotining of the French king, and the beginning of the Reign of Terror. Quite the contrary. He tried to defend the French king from assassination and from guillotine, and it almost cost him his head. But the way it developed in France was a different way than in America. This would be a course in its own right as to how the American Revolution came to France. The word French Revolution is actually a misnomer. That was a revolution turned sour, and it was not really in the long run a revolution, it was a bloodbath. It did not turn France around to freedom, it merely changed one form of tyranny into a slightly modified, but essentially similar form of tyranny with another king, except this time he called himself emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte. But it was not without total permanent effect, except it took longer. Ultimately, the Bonaparte regime, the Bourbon regime, which replaced that, finally disintegrated. And France became very much similar to the United States in political republican structure. Great Britain, the ancient home of monarchy. The British love kings to this day. They can't seem to live without kings in England, or in Holland, or in Belgium, or in Norway, or in Sweden. They can't get rid of this. They can't shake the habit. But they did. These countries are also republics today, except in name. They still call themselves monarchies. They still have a British king, except this time it's a female, so it's called queen. But they still have a king in England. They still have a king in Holland, or it's also a queen. They have a king in Norway. They have a king in Sweden. But this is just a name. That's a title. These characters are totally impotent. They don't run the show anymore. These are not really monarchies any longer. They are republics in all but name. They are more republics, for example, than, let's say, China, which calls itself a republic but is really a monarchy, because Mao Zedong is as much of a king as any country ever had, except he doesn't have the title. Things are a little topsy-turvy these days. That isn't the only thing that went upside down. Today we call most things which are immoral, moral. Most things which are moral are called immoral. Things which are liberal are called conservative. Things which are conservative are called liberal. Things which are reactionary are called liberal. Things which are progressive are called reactionary. And things which are reactionary are called progressive. Everything is upside down. The whole semantics of our society has become turned upside down. Why, even the men begin to look like women these days. If you look at these beatniks, with long hair, I mean, everything is upside down these days. And this is part of our degeneracy. But the point I'm driving at is, the American Revolution hit Europe very hard. It took about 50 years longer than in America. And what is called liberalism spread through Europe. And in Europe, the word liberal is still a little bit less distorted than in America. The word liberal is still regarded more in connection with the original concept there than here. But there is a problem. This did not happen without a cloud. This silver lining has a cloud. The great expansion of wealth, which happened in America and later in Europe through the American Revolution's influence. And what is the American Revolution? Pure and simple. The elimination of the concept that man is ruled by another man. The elimination of kingship. This, in principle, says there shouldn't be any rulers. But we know better. We have rulers. And yet, I seem to be contradicting myself here, but I'm not. It just seems to be a confusion here. The American Revolution eliminates monarchy in principle, and yet we've got rulers which are tougher than the old kings. What happened? In the early days of the American Republic, by which I mean the first century, there were coercive rules. The Declaration of Independence was scrapped. Not officially. I mean, it's still enshrined. I mean, they keep it in a frame, like we keep it in a frame, except they got they have the original one as a captive of those who don't believe in it. And I gotta settle for the facsimile print copies. The original is a prisoner of those who have opposed it. The point is, the Declaration of Independence is enshrined, but it's disregarded. The Declaration of Independence clearly says, and I'll read this again, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. I don't remember ever being consulted on whether I wish to pay an income tax. I have never given my consent to this, you know. I don't know about you. If you did, that's your problem. But I have never given my consent to this. I have never given my consent to any tax while we're on the subject. I've never given my consent to the antitrust laws. I have never given my consent to the Federal Reserve Act. I have never given my consent to business license laws. I have never given my consent to the people who tell me how to drive my automobile and whether or not I may drive it at all. I might add that the people who give permission to drive are not the ones who invented the automobile. The only one who really should have the authority to give that permission is the fellow who invented the thing. Things are so bad, ladies and gentlemen, that if I invented a particular device, pretty soon I'd have to get a permit from the state to use my own product. You realize that? I know that when I, as an astrophysicist, before I made my own Declaration of Independence, when I still worked for a company which derived its livelihood from state contracts, which I disapprove of, I remember that everything I worked on was classified either confidential or secret. I haven't got access to my own work unless they give me permission. If I write something, they can withhold permission for me to see my own writing. It's that bad. Now, the point is, I don't recall any time giving consent to any of the things that are happening. So the Declaration of Independence has been completely perverted. But wait till the next sentence. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to effect their safety and happiness. That's called treason these days to advocate a new government. I don't mean a new administration. I don't mean just throw this rascal out and put the new one in. I mean a new concept of government. Now, let's get it clear. We can't have it both ways. We either eat our cake or we have our cake. We can't have it both ways. We either believe the Declaration of Independence is valid or we don't. The Declaration of Independence clearly states the principle that man is above government. And if the government doesn't please the man, he can get to change it, alter or abolish it. Now, of course, most people think this is treason. Why? They say, well, you want to overthrow the government. Did I use the word overthrow? No, and I don't plan to. What did I say before, earlier this evening? I said, you cannot get rid of a tyranny by fighting tyrants. That's strange. That's a paradox, apparently, on the surface. But if you go into this more deeply, the science of volition, which is taught in V50, you will see that this is a very easily explained and very logical concept. You cannot get rid of tyranny by fighting tyrants, for a very good reason. Tyranny doesn't exist independently of something else, which is more important. There is a something else which has to be defined before you know what tyranny is. What's that? It's opposite, freedom. They are not independent of each other. These are not two different things which are at opposite ends of the pole. They are one thing of which the one is a negation of the other. There is only one thing in this world, and that's called freedom in terms of human volition. You either have it or you don't have it. If you have freedom, you don't have tyranny. If you don't have freedom, you have tyranny by default. Now that's a key point. This is an exact reversal of what everyone in the world, to speak of, believes in today. Most people believe the exact opposite of what I just said. I'm going to repeat this. This is that important. Most people believe that if you want freedom, you must get rid of tyranny. Because they think tyranny is a real thing, and you must eliminate it and fight it and get rid of it in order to have the other thing called freedom. Whereas, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. The real thing which exists, which has positive existence and reality in the world, is freedom. And if you eliminate that, then you have tyranny by default. And if you look upon freedom as the goal, and not merely what you have left if you get tyranny, if you get rid of tyranny, if you reverse your position, and reverse your perspective, and reverse your mechanism, and put it into a different orientation, you will go in a different direction than mankind has ever gone before, and you'll find the destination you can't locate the other way. Please remember that this is a very bad analogy, and I confess this in advance, but one way to go east is sail west, as Columbus and Leif Erikson and Magellan demonstrated. The earth is round. If you sail west, you'll reach the eastern part of the world. I'd like to say something which is a better analogy, a far better one. It's from thermodynamics. Hot and cold are not two different things. In science, there's only one. Heat. There is such a thing as heat. There's no such thing as cold. Cold is the absence of heat. There's no physical entity called cold. Cold is merely a physiological sensation that you feel as a living being when you don't have enough of the thing called heat. Heat is a form of energy. It involves a form of energy which manifests itself through molecular movements, for example. And the larger amount of this energy exists, you in general measure it in terms of another physical measurable called temperature. And then when you have less of this form of energy called heat or internal energy, then the temperature falls and you call that cold. Cold doesn't have an independent existence of heat. Tyranny has not got an independent existence of freedom. You don't get freedom by fighting tyranny. You get freedom by building it. And when you're successful, you know how, you can't have tyranny because tyranny has to exist only by thriving on the absence of freedom. Now, what is freedom? This is the thing that eluded the 18th century people. This is why the American Revolution is only partially complete. The rest of it is now. I'm calling this the continuation of, or the succession of, or the second phase of the American Revolution. I maintain that the original American Revolution failed for only one reason. They were on the right track, Paine and his colleagues were on the right track, but they didn't eliminate the state. They only eliminated one aspect or one manifestation of the state called king, and they invented another one which is worse. which is anchored on a different form of coercion, a different form of attacking human beings, attacking their volition, getting people to obey without their own choices being consulted. Understand this. There are two ways to get a human being to act according to your will, both of which are coercive. Then there's a third way to get a person to act, which is not coercive. If you want a man to do something, like, for example, just give you an illustration. You want a man to walk across the room. Forget the reason, doesn't matter. But you want him to do something, like walk across the room from here to there. You pull out a gun on him, and you say, "Now march. I want you going from here to there. If you don't, I'll pull the trigger." The man will do it. Why? He's afraid of big shot. The alternative is death, and he doesn't choose that. He doesn't really want to go to the other side of the room, but he likes being shot even less. This is called physical coercion. That's called force. Kings practice this. It doesn't have to be a gun. It could be a spear, or it could be just simply a man with a tougher set of muscles, or it could be a guy with a bomb. Anyhow, you exercise enough physical brute force to scare him with the reprisal of injury or death, and then he will march across the room. Because he's afraid of the consequences, which would involve physical injury or death to him if he didn't. That's one way to get him to act. There's another way to get him to act. Tell him to go from here to there across the room. You can tell him, "You want to go to the other side of the room and pick up a pot of gold which is waiting for you there." Now, there's no pot of gold there. As a matter of fact, there's a trap door. He'll fall into a well and die. But you don't tell him that. You want to go there. You want to actually get him to drop into the hole. But you don't tell him this. You tell him, "You go over there, there's a pot of gold for you." This is called deception. It's fraud. It's intentional deception. You convince him to do this, that it's in his own interest, but it's not in his own interest. He's going to be really unhappy. He's going to suffer for it. But you don't tell him, "Go to the other side of the room and you'll drop into a well and die." Instead, you say, "Go to the other side of the room and pick up your fortune." And then you trap him into falling into the well. I mean, these are a little far-fetched analogies. I'm just saying that there are two ways to get him to go. They're both of which, of course, this is deception. You convince him that it's in his interest when actually it is not in his interest. There's also a third way to get him to go to the other side of the room. Tell him that if he goes to the other side of the room, then you in turn will do something for him that he wants you to do. And you'll exchange services. That's called mutual profit. That's not coercive. A free society is based upon the third. The American Revolution, in its first form, fell into the trap of the second. They recognized the physical coercion is wrong to have a guy, man, pull out a gun and say, "Now march. I'm your boss, I'm your king, I'm your tribal chief. Do as I say or I'll shoot you." So they set up an elaborate system of social structure involving laws and who makes this and who does that. One group of people make laws. This is called a legislature. And they make it a big committee because they figure a lot of these dodos in a big committee are going to make a lot less destructive rules than if you have just one fellow like a king making all the rules. Well, if you have a big committee, you know, committees are ineffective and usually every committee is as strong as its weakest member, and if that strong. And so if you figure you keep the rules dilute. And that's the purpose of the original American Revolution, to make the rules of coercion as dilute and as weak as possible. This is what led to the presently used concept and widely circulated concept, which is called limited government. You limit the government. You don't let it get out of hand. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this won't work. But they didn't realize that at that time. And that's a little beyond the scope of this short course as to why it won't work. That's fully developed in the science of volition. But I want to point out at this level, at this juncture, that in the early times of the American Republic and the ensuing imitations of the American Republic that occurred in Europe, where the various monarchies yielded to imitations of what happened in America, what happened was that the rules were spread around so that you have a big committee making the rules. In England, it's called Parliament. In America, it's called Congress. In some countries, it's called an assembly or a national assembly or a federal assembly. In Switzerland, it's called the Federal Assembly. In Germany, it was called the Reichstag. You give it a different name in each country. It's a big bunch of people that operate in a committee fashion, and none of them are really able to be the big cheese alone. They're all sort of watering each other down. And then, of course, one fellow who is not a part of this, he is going to enforce the rules that this organization makes. And he's the executive. And you can call him president, or you can call him chancellor, or premier, or prime minister, or generalissimo, or whatever you want to call him. But he's the fellow, he takes the key place of the king ultimately. But this doesn't emerge until, that's getting ahead of the act. And actually, in the early days, he doesn't really know what he's going to do. The way it was set up in America, the president didn't know what he was going to do, really. Now, if you really want to investigate American history deeply, you will know that in the early days, the American president didn't have much to do, and he was quite confused, actually, as to just what he could do. The Constitution doesn't specify too clearly. The Constitution doesn't even say who his assistants are. It just says he has department heads, but doesn't name one department. What is now called a cabinet was arrived at by act of Congress, item by item. There's not one department or branch of the federal state that is specified in the Constitution. The Department of State, the Department of the Treasury, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of War, the Department of Navy, which has been united under the Department of Defense, these are not specified in the Constitution. They have to be individually enacted into law and prescribed to exist. There's no mention of the Securities Exchange Commission. There's no mention of the Federal Communications Commission. There's no mention of this Public Works Administration or Works Project Administration or Peace Corps or Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. None of these are specified. All of these were added item by item, one by one, and in the early days, they had to figure out what to add, when, how, and who does it. And there was all kinds of bickering and great jealousies. In the early days, we had some pretty smart people in the act. I mean, Jefferson, for example, was a pretty smart fellow in his own right. He's no Thomas Paine, but that's why he was president. But in any event, as far as politicians are concerned, let me say that he was a grand fellow. And he meant no harm. That's a heck of a lot more than I can say for anybody today. He meant no injury to the nation. He said, bind men down from mischief by the chains of a constitution. Don't trust anyone in power. And he applied that to himself. Well, in the early days, the rules were pretty tenuous. Hard to find out what they were. The rules were changed. New game we were playing. The old game was scrapped. King rules, everybody obeys. Well, in this interim, interregnum, that's the period between kings. In this interregnum, it so happened that since nobody really knew who to turn to, oh, of course, the laws had to be interpreted. I forgot the judiciary. Then you had to set up a set of courts to interpret what the laws mean, since nobody knew it anyhow. They still don't, but in those days they admitted it. They didn't know what the laws meant. But in any event, the point is, while the rules were so confused, and the taxes couldn't be levied on a high level, on a high scale. First of all, what are now called income taxes were directly outlawed in the Constitution. And that had to be changed by constitutional amendment later. And so consequently, the seizure of property by the state was relatively small. The incentive was very large to build. After all, a person wanted to do something useful. A huge country. Boy, that 3 million square miles and just a couple of people in the whole country. When it started with only 3 million people to 3 million, well, it wasn't really 3 million square miles yet because this was, at that time, the United States only extended as far as the Mississippi. But 3 million people in 1 million square miles, which later became 3 million square miles, that's only three people to the square mile. And that isn't a fair count because most of those 3 million people were huddled on the eastern seaboard. They were in towns like Philadelphia and Boston and New York and there were other colonies in Virginia, Georgia, and so forth, Maryland. They were all there. There was hardly anybody out in the wilderness in Ohio and Kentucky and in Tennessee. Well, this was as empty as today Nevada after an atomic bomb blast. Well, I'm not referring to Las Vegas now. I'm referring to other parts of Nevada which are not heavily populated. The point is, people had a place to go to and build. And if anyone found the state oppressive in the 19th century, and believe me, there were some people who found it oppressive even then, notably Henry David Thoreau, who will be remembered, in my judgment, indefinitely, as a man who recognized tyranny even when it was so small that most people wouldn't even notice it. He thought it was terribly great, the tyranny. He wrote a pamphlet called Civil Disobedience. How do you suppose he'd react today? In any event, as the 20th century economist Ludwig von Mises says, well, even if you found the state oppressive in America at that time, all you have to do is move 5 miles further west, and you're out of the clutches of the state. But then the bureaucrats came after you and settled down and started making rules for you, so you moved still further 5 miles west until we got to the west coast. And now we have to continue moving 5 miles further west and build an aquatic civilization, maybe. That's a possibility, too, through superior technology. The point is, in the early years, namely the first century of the American Republic, the rules were confused. But then they got firmed up, and pretty soon people got to realize, I can do this, and I can go this so far, but this guy is standing in my way. In the next door department, there's a fellow who's obstructing me. So finally, the chicanery and political shenanigans started developing, and the lines of strength and coercion were firmed up until all the powers were concentrated again. And today we're now living in a very highly bureaucratized society, far worse than the original monarchy. Does this mean there was something wrong with the American Revolution in its original form? Yes and no. It was not complete. It was something wrong with it to the extent that it was not a full development. Were its principles wrong? No. That's to the everlasting credit of the 18th century liberals, Paine, his antecedents, and some of his colleagues. They realized that a society should be based on natural law, but they didn't fully know how to do it, and they missed a couple of very important ingredients. Now, this should not be construed as a criticism of them, because I don't intend it that way. If I know more than they do, it's because I'm standing on their shoulders, and I probably would have made the same mistakes in the 18th century. But today, I'm not in the 18th century. I have the benefit of the experience which is at my disposal in terms of what they did and what happened afterwards, and I'm able to profit from it, and I don't act like the ordinary person who calls himself a conservative in America, which means he wishes to conserve the revolution and the Constitution, and say, well, that's the greatest thing that ever happened. We can never hope to improve on this. We just have to restore the old republic, the old constitution, and we can kick out the present socialists, and we've got it made. No, we can't be that comfortable and smug. If we only restore the old constitution and the old republic in its original form, we won't be farther ahead. Because if it were perfect, it couldn't have gone wrong. A perfect system can't go haywire. There was something wrong. What is wrong is that they didn't have the full knowledge, the full science of volition developed. They tried. What is the key point in the science of volition? I'll say that much even this evening in this introductory lecture. The key point is the definition of freedom. I said freedom is a positive concept which you obtain through a certain means, and then if you do this, there is no way in or no way back for tyranny. Well, what does this consist of? I can't go into the explanation of how you develop it, that's in the main V50 course. But what I can say is what the concept of freedom itself is, in its modern, full-fledged terminology. What it really means, and how it differs from the 18th century approximation at it. It was on the right track, though. Freedom is intrinsically connected with property. Man is a sovereign being. This is implicit in the Declaration of Independence. Man is his own ruler, not a subservient to a king. So far, so good. Now, how are you your own ruler? How do you control your own life? You control your own life in only one possible way, and that is by controlling in full everything that is derived from your existence. That is how I define property. I define property as man's life, individual man's life, and all non-procreative derivatives of his life. Please note, this is not a definition which means chairs and houses and television sets and furniture and clothing and things like that. These are all property, to be sure, but they're not the only kinds of property. Property is a broader and deeper concept. Everything that is derived from a man's life is his property. If it's derived through his own volition, without external interference and without external coercion. Now, if a man is able to control his own property, by the way, control means the ability to make decisions without interference from others, self-volition, in other words, then he is personally, individually free. If, on the other hand, this becomes not a single unique characteristic of one man, but it becomes characteristic of all human beings in a society, that all human beings are personally in full control over everything that is derived from their own lives, then that is a condition of freedom. If all men are 100% in full control over their own property at all times, then that is a free society. Now, on that basis, the American Revolution probed towards this. This was an intended goal. But they didn't have this full definition. The closest that was arrived at, as you might have guessed, was stated by Thomas Paine. I think several other people independently of Paine also thought of it, but Paine directly is known to have said, "Liberty is the right to do anything you want so long as it does not interfere with the similar rights of others." That's very close to what I define freedom, but it's not as precise. It's in that lack of precision. It's in that small problem, the lack of precision, that our whole world has collapsed. Paine said, "Liberty is the right to do all that everything you please so long as it does not interfere with the similar rights of others." That's not a verbatim quote, but that's the gist of it. Well, how do you know what rights are? What are rights? What is meant by similar rights? Where does one man's right begin and another one's end? Where's the boundary? That's not precise. But the way I defined it, it's the same concept, but it's far more precise. Man's life and all non-procreative voluntary derivatives of his life are his property. Freedom is the societal condition wherein every individual is 100% in control over his own property. That implies that he is not in control over anybody else's property to any extent, because if he were, then that other person couldn't have his control over his property. If one man controls someone else's property, then the one who has property control doesn't enjoy self-control. So a universal condition of self-control of property is freedom, the definition of freedom. Well, you may say, well, that has never existed. Go to the head of the class. That's right. It has never existed. That's why we've never had freedom. But that's a concept which is within the possible world to achieve. This is not impossible. Quite the contrary. When the technology is widely known, it will not only not be impossible, it will pass from the difficult to the simple as soon as it's known how to do it. Now, this is taught in V50s, the how to do it, what it means and how to do it. It's actually quite a simple concept. It does not produce anarchy, as you might at first blush think. If everybody does as he pleases, well, everything will go to pot. Oh, no. It cannot. Because he cannot do as he pleases with someone else's property, only with his own. If he wants to touch someone else's property, he has to get that person's consent. That means for a contractual relationship between them. And they will work in each other's interests, and they will work for each other's mutual profit. If you want a man to go to the other end of the room for you, you don't threaten to shoot him. You don't promise him a pot of gold and he falls in a pot of gold and then he falls into a well. Instead, you say, if you go to the other side of the room as I'd like you to, I'll do something that you'd like me to do, and we'll exchange. And it's mutually profitable. Well, this concept leads to a completely voluntary society. You don't need any coercion, any rules made by any big cheese, whether you call them tribal chief, duke, king, baron, president, chancellor, general, senator, dog catcher, or vulture. It leads to no political control over man over man. It not only eliminates tribal chiefs, it eliminates witch doctors. That's the second step of the American Revolution. The elimination of fraud, wherein a man convinces you that it's in your interest to commit suicide. You know, there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, except that you forget telling him that he's going to fall into the well. These are all, of course, just simple and not factual illustrations. You don't really promise a man a pot of gold and he falls into the well. Instead, you tell him it's in his own interest to pay income taxes. It's in his own interest to go fight in Asia to defend people who didn't ask to be defended and who we don't even know and don't care about and would like us to leave and for us to die there. It's to convince a man that it's in his own interest to be robbed of his own property so that that property can be converted into wheat to be sent to our own enemies who can then eat heartily and build guns to shoot us with. It's to tell a man that it's in his own interest to pay a farmer not to grow wheat so that the price of wheat will go up and we'll have to pay more for the bread we buy and have to pay the farmer not to grow the wheat to cause our bread price to rise. It's a tremendous concept. As a matter of fact, I might also say that if anybody really wanted to design a society for collapse, this is the one they would have picked. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the American Revolution is a present-day concept. It is a living thing. The American Revolution is no different today than in the 18th century, except that it's farther along. Now we have the technique to eliminate not only force but fraud. Not only the tribal chief but the witch doctor. And by eliminate, I don't mean shoot. We leave that to the John Wilkes Booth and Lee Harvey Oswald. They can do the shooting. They deserve each other. These murderers and their victims deserve each other. It's only a question of who kills who. The point is, the way to achieve freedom is not by fighting tyranny, but to realize that freedom consists of a major intellectual accomplishment which has to have a physical, tangible application to reality. The accomplishment is this. Learn a method by which you're capable of protecting your property fully. And that method cannot exist independently of the property of other people. My property isn't secure unless yours is secure. Yours isn't secure unless mine is secure. We have a mutual profit in seeing to it that neither you nor I are plundered. And we can find profitable exchanges to make whereby we can increase the protection of our respective properties. If we learn how to do this competently, then anyone who wants to come around and say, your money or your life, you laugh in his face and say, what do you mean your money or your life? How can you threaten me? You got a pea shooter. I got nuclear energy at my disposal, except that I don't plan to use it against you. I'm planning to build a spaceship to Arcturus. But, of course, if you get in my way and point that pea shooter in my face, I might just have to let you have just a little bit of my rocket vehicle's exhaust. I might turn in your direction. This is all a figurative way of talking. But the point is, those who wield coercion, namely tribal chiefs and witch doctors, they're not very bright, you know. They're not the Newtons. They're not the Thomas Paine. They don't build iron bridges. They don't build engines. They coerce. They command people who do. Well, those who can't do these things, if they can become successful at protecting their own achievements, they don't have to take guff from those who can build nothing except hot air. The state, the wielder of coercion, the perpetrator of tyranny, has no independent existence other than that we sanction it. How do we sanction it? By abdicating our personal responsibility in our own property. If we learn how to increase our ability to make property, produce property on a higher plane, with greater effectiveness, it'll be valuable to us to see to it that it isn't plundered. If you have $1 million, I think it's worth $1,000 or so to make sure that the other $999,000 isn't stolen. You might spare $1,000 to see to it that you hire someone to protect it from a thief. The more property you have, the more you'll cherish it. Now, there's one thing else that was wrong in the defective is the better word. Incomplete in the original American Revolution. The definition of property which I gave you was not in full swing. To them, property meant tangibles. It meant the physical things you can touch. Houses are property, chairs are property, clothing is property, food is property, horse carriage is property, that's what they had in those days. These are property. Ideas are also property, ladies and gentlemen. Moreover, they're the strongest and highest form of property. Now, a few people like James Madison and Thomas Paine both knew that. They both indicated that this is true. But they didn't have any effective mechanism to treat this in the market. Instead of merely talking about it, they had no way of reducing it to an operational reality. And so as a result, we have built a whole world on trying to protect lives and property in the secondary or tangible sense, without having any ability to protect property in the primary sense, which means the property in ideas. That's the original property of man. That's why I call it primary. If a man who develops ideas can be plundered, then all the things that are built through the use of those ideas can also be plundered. You cannot have an automobile till someone conceives of one first. You cannot have an electric toaster till someone thinks of it first. It's pretty easy to defend the toaster from being stolen if the fellow who invented it hasn't been robbed first. But that's the way it happens. People who invent toasters usually make $1,000, and the people who put them on the market make millions. That's not a moral society, where the man who create the greatest wealth gets the least compensation. Where a man who discovers a law of gravitation, such as Albert Einstein, he had a higher and more advanced law of gravitation than the earlier one of Newton. When a man such as Albert Einstein can't make as much money as a tap dancer, are you surprised that Albert Einstein was a socialist? I'm not. I think it's the most natural thing in the world. If in the world of money, his services with his giant mind are valued at a lower compensation than a tap dancer or a salesman who sells ladies' underwear or a bugle player or a baseball player, if these people can make more money than the greatest minds in physics of the 20th century, well, it's surprising that he doesn't think that money is a proper standard of value and that chases him into the socialist camp. Now, when you can integrate the property in the mind, the property in ideas, with the property of tangible things which come out of ideas, then you have the American Revolution in full swing in high gear, and it will be irreversible. That, incidentally, is hinted at in our basic course V50, quite deeply, I might have not just hinted, it's developed fairly deeply there, but then it's fully developed in much greater scope in the successor course, V201, The Nature and Protection of Primary Property. When you can protect primary property, property and ideas, the American Revolution is irreversible and it becomes complete. And the revolution will then become final. What that means is the society will then finally be turned completely around to freedom. And you never have to fight a tyrant in all this process. You never have to shoot a king or a president. You never have to vote against a dog catcher or any other kind of a fellow in office. You never have to do a thing to oppose, to fight, as the 20th century philosopher Spencer Heath said. He referred to the people who are always opposed as the againsters, those who are against this and against that. You don't have to be against anything. You have to be for a creative, positive achievement of man, freedom, the self-control of property. When you can do that, who can attack you? Tyranny only can come into existence when people can attack your property successfully. And in the attack on property, you lose your freedom. It's not the attack on tyranny that produces freedom, it's the attack on freedom that produces tyranny. And if you can reconcile your mind to that single revolutionary concept, the second phase of the American Revolution is here. And that carries it even one step higher. And I might add, I predict it's the final and last and supreme step, which will make tyranny completely a thing of the past. And I'd like to not leave you without restoring an earlier point tonight. It was too far ago in the evening's lecture. I don't want you to forget it. I want you to lose some sleep over the crisis you're in. Don't forget that. I want you to lose some sleep over this. This is not a matter of indifference. Well, I can take it or leave it. This is not a course on basket weaving, which you can take or leave. You will not have a physical existence, probably, before the end of this century. Or your children will not have a physical existence by the end of this century, in all probability, if the present trend continues. We are now smart enough through physical and biological technology to wipe out every human being on this planet. This is not a joke. It's not an empty threat. I'm not threatening you. I'm not the one who's threatening to kill you. I'm just recognizing an existing fact. Through physical and biological technology, we are capable of wiping out the human species. Through the absence of volitional technology, we are not capable yet of behaving ourselves and using our knowledge for constructive and useful purposes instead of destructive purposes. That means we've got 300 years of catching up to do right now. Not next century, because next century will be too late. There won't be opportunity to do this. Not next decade, because by then it might be too late to get started. Right now, we have 300 years to catch up on between physics and volition. Physics was integrated into a universal science 300 years ago. Volition is an integrated science now. But it has to be known by enough people who can create the change from tyranny to freedom right now, so you don't abdicate your existence and the existence of your posterity. Thank you.